It's Özlem Özkan, and this is Bridging, a podcast which will take you on a bridge through somewhere else, sometimes somewhere familiar, and sometimes somewhere new. The coming 9 episodes, I will be interviewing people across the world, people who not only have experience with cultural diversity, but are culturally diverse people. They are from the US, Morocco, Netherlands, Venezuela, France, Mexico, Turkey, Denmark, Spain, Germany, and Curaçao. While some of them grew up with two cultures, some of them moved to another country later on in life. Sometimes their curiosity and instinct led them to the right country, and sometimes it was their parents. Adventure, confusion, and time-by-time loneliness made them evolve and build strength. Sometimes it took only one person to cut their judgments into ribbons. Some were called Frenchie in high school. Some took a totally different direction than anyone in the family. Some chose to build a life based on their curiosity instead of building a resume. Some left a big ocean behind, and they all learned how to move ahead in life. And getting challenged wasn't always easy, yet it was a good thing, because they got to know themselves. They're all different and unique, yet they all share something common, their unique superpower, created as a byproduct of their life moving between cultures, nations, and sometimes religions. I am very excited and honored to be with Malika Ouachia. Malika is raised in the Netherlands by Moroccan parents. She is a cultural and social anthropologist and still does her PhD at the VU University in Amsterdam and serves at different organizations. Yet she is much more than her studies and other positions she is holding. Here is Malika.
Welcome, Malika.
Thank you.
You were born and raised in the Netherlands, and both of your parents are Moroccan origin. Mm-hmm. And you were born in the city Alkmaar, where I was also born. We were we grew up in the same neighborhood, actually in the same street with your sisters and brothers. I grew up.
Yeah.
And so you lived together with the Moroccan and Dutch culture.
Right.
How did your life look like with the two cultures, with the Moroccan and Dutch culture?
Well, it's very rich and it's very loaded. It has both sides. It has a good side and it has a bad side, or almost like a challenging side rather. When I was a child, we would spend the summers in Morocco, so we would be away for a month and a half, sometimes 2 months, and then we would spend the winters in France. So I would have all these linguistic influences, right? And also all these different views on life itself, on how to live life as a girl, as a woman, what roles everybody should play, what position you should give them. So with all these cultures around you and you trying to figure out yourself, it can be quite challenging. And it was, it really was. And it is sometimes still. I think the way to express, to look back on it basically was, I think the fact that we don't really had an example to follow made it challenging. And I think my parents had the same thing, because I mean, when they came to Europe, they moved to France first and then they moved to the Netherlands. No one really prepared them for the countries and the societies they were going to be part of. They just had to figure it out themselves. And I think that same figuring out yourself thing is very related to my life. I mean, you just had to try things to see if that was your thing or if it wasn't. And then, I mean, I wouldn't do like crazy stuff as in, you know, like drug use or whatever, even though I saw people do that around me, which is totally okay. But I would, for example, had to figure it out with clothing and to see if, you know, what everybody was wearing in the Moroccan community, was it my thing or was it not my thing? I would have the same thing with social activities or hobbies or, I mean, the horizon you get is very broad, but I think the way to put it best is to see it as you trying to figure out the right pen to be able to get that dot on that horizon and then be able to, you know, despite everything that is happening around you, build your own road towards that dot on the horizon. And to also like stick to that despite everything and despite people that may be disappointed or who won't be disappointed, you know, to just always follow your heart in that. And to call, I think eventually what happened was that I was creating my own culture and that I was coming across people that either could relate to the way I created my tribe or couldn't relate. And, you know, that's the influence you would see if something that I would do would be very Dutch or something that I would do would be very Moroccan. There's no one dominant culture existing in my life. And I think that's the product of, you know, living life as a Moroccan Dutch, Dutch Moroccan.
So you mentioned like the product, like that you need to make the best out of it. You can take both of the cultures. Yet, you know, the words are sometimes nice. It looks nice. And, you know, yes, we should follow our heart. We should just do our thing. We should find our place. But what is the experience behind this? You were talking about it was challenging initially. That was the first instance you said it was challenging. What challenged you the most when living in the Netherlands with a Moroccan family, going to a Dutch school, visiting France during winter because you have family there, visiting Morocco during summer, and 10 months, 9 months being in the Netherlands with a total different culture than the Moroccan?
I think in my life, what always was the case was the fear to disappoint. That's like a brutal, honest answer on your question. I was always afraid to let down the people that fed me, the people that raised me, the people that believed in me or wanted me to do something that I didn't really know what they were talking about, but then they mentioned it and then they said, when you grow up, you'll understand. I think that was always the fear that I had or that made the experience challenging. You know, I didn't want to be led by the fear that I felt, but at the same time, I didn't want to lose them while not caring about what was said, right? Yeah, I think I was constantly just trying to please everybody. And I mean, you would have people at your home base, and then it would be like home as in at my parents' place, but then it would be also be home as in at my aunt's place. It would be home as in Morocco based. It would be, you know, like all these different islands basically that you would pop between, you know. But then you'd also have these expectations that your teachers have, that your sport mates had, the girls you would hang out with that would have all these different backgrounds. And I could always relate with girls like you who would also grow up in, you know, the bicultural situations. But I would always have this feeling towards Dutch friends, either girls or boys, that life was so simple. For them, yeah. Because for us, we would have, you know, we were always having these different things back home. The food was different, the holidays were different, the way we spoke to each other, the, you know, the four languages in one household instead of just one. Yeah, I remember thinking to myself, your life is so simple, or your life is so easy to follow. You know, I didn't have that, and I'm grateful I didn't have that, because you didn't know you would be able to move between all these different countries on an older age, you know, when you grow older. But as a kid, you don't want that. As a kid, you just want to have what everybody else has.
Yes.
You know, you don't want to make it any complicated, or you don't want to make a certain scene out of something because it's just not what you think you need. You know, it's what your parents gave you that they thought you need.
Yeah.
And you had to settle with that, right? Even though you had information towards other situations. Yeah, like I said, it was the fear of not disappointing, but it was also the muscles I had to stretch to just settle for the situation as it was, even though in my heart I wanted something else. Even though I didn't always know what I wanted. It was just something else than the reality.
There was a desire towards something else. Also,
there was
the thought
indeed.
Of your Dutch friends might have an easier life. Maybe they did not have. We don't know that. But maybe it
we
looked
don't, yeah.
like that. They had
right.
a much easier life because you had to deal with, at home, a different front, at school, a different front, the family, the schoolmates.
Yeah, because, you know, the assumption I made on my Dutch friends, actually, one of the friends that I indeed made such an assumption for, I met her years later, and then we sat down, and then she opened up on the situation back home for her, and it wasn't that simple as I thought it always was, because her parents went through a divorce, and when we went to the same school, they were basically, you know, she just had a very rough situation back home, and she said, I always loved coming over at your place because it was so full and warm. And even though you know, you had your siblings always around you, I didn't have that at home because I felt alone and my parents were always fighting. Yeah, when I heard that, I was like, you know, I mean, I had tears in my eyes when she was saying that. When you think of it, it's just, it puts so much into reality. It puts so much into perspective. I didn't know what to say when she told me that.
Yeah, actually, you already answered the next question I was going to ask you. It was like, was there something that you judged about the Dutch culture and the Moroccan culture before in the past and changed the way you think about it now? This situation with the girl might be one answer
that you thought
her life was simple until she opened up when you were both young adults. What about the Moroccan culture? Was there anything that you judged in the past and you changed the way of thinking now?
I judged the way everybody would be looking over my shoulders constantly. Like looking over someone's shoulders, meaning they were always following you. Like there was no privacy, right?
As Do you mean from the Moroccan community?
Yeah. But also back home, you know, like as a child, and I still have that right now. I love to be alone. I would always love to just sit in a room alone with a book and just read. They thought it was okay, but always to a certain extent. But I didn't have my limits in that. You know, I could do it for days and it wouldn't bother me. I think that was one of the things I just really disliked. Now that I grew up, I know why it was the case, but because they were just concerned and they love you and they are just, you know, they just want to make sure that you don't have any needs that are not being answered or whatever. But, you know, if I would go out or if I would see a friend or whatever, they always wanted me to do that in a certain way that fit with the expectations the social community would have. Because what if someone sees you outside and, you know, you would behave in a certain way and it's just not, you know, culturally appropriate. People will be talking and you would create a bad name for you and your family. And it created like this second voice in my head that everything you did, every act you made was your own reputation wasn't only the one, you know, being exposed. It was also the reputation of your family. So as a girl, you become like this body of the concept of reputation towards the family and the whole world. So if you as a Moroccan girl wouldn't, you know, get the right grades or whatever, it means that there's also something wrong with your family. It's, you know, your upbringing, there was something wrong in there. And that means that your parents are also being put on the stage as in, you know, by the community, as in you didn't do a good job
right.
raising her. I think that's one of the things that I really just didn't like. And I still don't like if I see it happening with other girls or other Moroccan girls who, you know, some of my Moroccan students do say these things to me. They share them in, you know, in times when they are just struggling with the expectations the home base has, but also the expectations society has, Dutch society has.
How did you deal with this community pressure that you felt?
At first, I really walked on my toes.
Right.
And sometimes one of my friends, one time he made a joke out of it and he said, well, I'm happy you're a ballerina because you guys know how to walk on your toes. So it's a cute way to
I learned it when I was a child.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you so much.
I had a hard time trusting people because I didn't know if I trusted someone, something may happen and you would get me in trouble and I would get in trouble with the family. And so I think those things created a certain strict behavior, a certain closed way of looking at humans. I'm just very happy that I've met people in my life who made me aware of these things. It's okay to open up a bit more. It's okay to talk about your feelings. It's okay to, you know, not everybody's out to hurt you. Not everybody's out to be your enemy or whatever. We're your friends. We'll always be your friends, no matter what you're going to say or no matter what you're going to do. So I really had to learn what it is to be unconditionally loved and accepted.
Okay, yeah, that's really interesting. It's really, I can recognize myself a lot in it. Like that's having control, wanting to have control. Like, hey, I shouldn't do this, I shouldn't say this, I shouldn't dance like this, I shouldn't walk here, etc. And then I shouldn't tell anyone about this.
Exactly.
And then, you know, opening really up, being vulnerable, showing who you truly are. Like, you know, that was for me writing the book was like, okay, this is gonna go out. This is it. There's nothing to hide here, which is also a relief of like, this is me with my imperfections, you know, with my mistakes, non-mistakes, with everything, what I am, that this is me. So now, actually, I would like to go to another topic. I would like to talk a little bit about your mother. And I got to know your mother. She was living just next door.
Right.
Your mom, unfortunately, passed away when you were 7 years old. And she had a big impact on your life. You know, she was a big role model for you. How did your life change after your mom passed away?
You know how to ask good questions. What happens if you put a house on fire? It burns down, right? You don't have a place to live. Well, I think that happened when my mom died in my life. Like the whole house just crashed. Everything inside of me crashed. I had to find the strength to build it all up in a way that it would take me to where I had to go. And I had to do that without knowing where I had to go, right?
You're fine. It's okay.
So, yeah. I had to indeed, like, I had to find the strength to not know where I was going to go to in life. But I had to make sure I would stay alive, you know? I didn't realize that on the age when she passed away. To be really honest, I didn't even know what it was. When I was 7 years old, you know, what did I know? So I thought death was, if someone died, I always thought as a kid, they would go to a place not away from this world we live in, and you would get to go there when you grow up. So I thought, okay, you know, I made a deal with myself. Look how a kid thinks, right? I would make a deal with myself, and I said, okay, you know, we're going to do our best and we're going to get good grades and we're going to grow up. And then when we grow up, we can go see mama. But as I grew older, I knew, you know, I understood the concept of death. And I started reading about it also, as in, because like from a Muslim perspective, people die and they go to Jannah. And that's the whole, that's the thing I always, got told by others who knew her. Your mother always said that too, like your mother is looking down on you from Jannah. She always said that as a kid or when I saw her in my teenage years. Like you're fine, you have a guardian angel. And But somehow that wasn't enough for me, because I had to understand what it meant to also live life with like an open wound, because that's what it was basically. And you're not always aware of that open wound because others made you aware of it when they knew who you were. So they wouldn't refer to me as my father's daughter. They always referred to me as my mother's daughter, but that daughter who doesn't have a mom. So it's like going through life without a leg. You know, there's always something missing. Mm-hmm. And that's also what I felt when I grew up. Like the first time I had a crush on a guy, and my girlfriends were telling their mothers, who was I was going to tell? Like, I didn't know who I was going to tell. I really missed that emotional go-to person. I started writing in my diary just after she died. So my diary actually became my mom. In a way, you know, I would write down what I would tell her. When I went to Morocco for my research, I just started looking for her legacy, for her footsteps. Like, who was she? Because I was tired of people telling me. I wanted to discover it myself. I wanted to discover it through the women that knew her. When I just wanted to know who she was. I just wanted to know how her upbringing was. And when I went to Morocco for my research, I just combined these two. I met women from several tribes in the region where we are from. We are from the High Atlas Mountains in Morocco, the southeast. It's very a rural area. So I just hopped between three tribes living in, I think, an area of maybe 40 kilometers. And I would just do that on market days, for example, when I knew like all these women would gather. Those were the perfect times to go and meet them and ask them about my mother. Or I would just, you know, ask them, can I come over? And, you know, I have some questions I want to ask you. And then when I would go, and then I would tell them, like, I want to know who my mother was. And my mother's death has been the fundament of the anthropologist that I am. I actually became a woman who is questioning things. And that's what you do as an anthropologist, right? You question things, you research things. I thought that if someone died, someone would go away. But now I know that death is just a transition to another reality that lives with ours, but not in the material context. You know, we don't see the death, but they're with us. So I don't see my mom, but I know she's with me. And when I realized that, life became a lot easier.
You know, I can just listen to your story for hours and hours here. Mm-hmm. So we will go back later on to the anthropologist, the work you do. But what I also would like to ask is about Mary. You met Mary when you were around 16 years old, when you were a teenager still. And Mary became a very important person in your life.
Right.
You described her as someone with unconditional love and unconditional compassion towards you. Can you tell a little bit more about your relationship with Mary and who Mary is for you?
It's interesting because we just talked about my birth mom, but Mary is actually the second lab that raised me. Yeah, she's my mom too, through adoption. But at the same time, she's one of the women that made a huge impact on my life. And basically, the best way to put it is I've been walking around with a certain type of glasses. And when I met her, she introduced me to a drawer full of glasses, right? So meaning she just taught me how to look at certain things from several perspectives in several ways. She introduced me to several ways how to live your life as a woman with, you know, the baggage that I have. Basically, what she taught me was love, like self-love also, but love as in the act. 9 years of missing motherly love, she filled those 9 years with so much grace, with so much strength, so much power, you know, an intellect and everything you can wish for. And I told her, like, I felt like what I said about the open wound, somewhere down the line, I got healed, and it was through her love. She's my mom in a very, very special way. And I think it's also through her that I've learned that family isn't always blood. There's a whole lot of other concepts that are important for us, you know, for us to be family or for people to become your family. When a woman teaches you something, you start looking at her womanhood and not so much as to her cultural identity, either Dutch, Moroccan, or whatever. I mean, to me, that's very important because our gender, in some cases, can be a much more powerful concept or a much more powerful motive behind what people do, you know?
So you are talking about the power of women, the powerful beings we are. Did you ever feel unequal to men?
No, but I felt sad when they thought I was unequal to them. And I think that was the base of my fight, or the fights that I've had.
So you believe yourself I'm equal, but you felt that others did not believe.
Exactly. They didn't see me as an equal. Other men, they didn't see me as an equal because I'm a woman. Yeah.
Did you have a feeling of convincing them, and why was this?
Yeah, indeed. I had a feeling of convincing them when I was younger. I had to convince them that I was an equal. So look at me, I'm going to do that. And then I did it. But then nothing changed. I realized only themselves, you know, they can only be convinced by themselves. You can do whatever you want. You can even learn how to walk on one hand, and still they're like, no, you didn't do that. Even though you just did that, like in front of the whole world. So I stopped convincing, and I just started doing shit. And I think that was the moment that I've seen men change their perspectives. And to be really honest, one of those men were my father. You know, my birth father, who wanted me to live a different life. And it was the life of a woman that he knew, which means, you know, you just get married and you have children, because I've seen women doing that, and they're happy. So I want that for you, but that may not be my happiness.
Do you understand where he is coming from?
Yeah, this idea? That's what I'm saying. Like, I know I like, these ideas are ideas he knows and he's familiar with. So you can't blame him for wanting that for you. Basically what he's saying is, I know the best thing, and the best thing I want is that for you, because that's how much I love you. But it's not what you wanted. So if I decided to indeed just, you know, go for my degrees and for my doctorate, and that means that you did something as a woman that is basically only for men in this, in the environment I am originally from. And that means that in the knowledge that you produce, in the knowledge that you have, you're competing with men. Or, I mean, they see that as you competing with them. But what I'm doing is, no, I'm just changing the stage. I'm just adding more gender to the stage. Because in our family, men are educated and women aren't. Well, let me change that for a sec, you know? And I mean, it's not that I didn't have support, but one time, and I'm quoting him in my dissertation, my uncle, it was at a wedding, a family wedding, and everybody was like, yeah, you're still not married, and what's up with that, and come on, and blah, blah, blah. And I just, you know, I just nodded, and that's the best thing you can do. Don't fight, just nod. You know, this will pass. And what he did, it was funny, because I was just sitting at the table and everybody was doing their thing, and he came to me and he said, you know, I heard the women asking you about your love life and you not being married, but you know, he said, I want you to get that doctor degree because we have enough wives in the family, but we don't have enough female doctors. So
beautiful. Really
and
nice.
When I, you know, when he said that, I was like, you are someone. I was, you know, that is the, it takes one person in the family to see that. And you're like, okay, indeed, you guys want for me what you know, but that's okay. But let me do something else. Let me introduce you guys to another possibility.
And maybe even you will do both. You will be and a wife and an anthropologist, a professor, whatever you want to be.
Well, who knows, you know?
Yeah. So there are many girls out there with a Moroccan background, a Turkish background, or any other, you know, Middle Eastern background, which have big cultural gaps between the Turkish and the Dutch, the Middle Eastern and the Dutch, Moroccan and the Dutch.
Right.
What kind of message would you like to give to these girls that feel stuck in between? Like, on one hand, they do not want to disappoint their communities, their family, the upbringing, you know, the gratitude also that they have for it. But on the other hand, they have their own dreams, own desires, you know, they think out of the box. They want to do things which none of the family members have ever done. What would you recommend? What would your advice be?
What my advice would be, follow that. Follow those desires. Follow those dreams. And despite of what everybody is going to say in the beginning, but don't lose your contact with them. Take them along and don't force upon them. They may be forcing upon you. That's not working because that's not, you know, approached by someone younger. So do respect the values, do respect the norms, do respect them and where they came from, but don't shorten yourself. Don't be afraid to disappoint them and then disappointing yourself along the way. Don't do that. In the end of the day, when you do what you do and you also show them like, I love you guys. I love where we come from. I'm proud of where we come from. And you did what you want to do. You did them a bigger favor than they would ever think of you would do. But don't tell them that. Don't be the know-all. Just do it. If you feel stuck, that's okay. Everybody feels stuck. I've met people who think, who have like this image of, oh my God, they made it and they are the ones feeling so stuck. I think that's good. If you feel stuck, life wants to make you grow. So it makes you uncomfortable first.
Yeah. Same feeling here.
Yeah. And that's good. That's good.
You are a social cultural anthropologist. You have done research in France, Morocco, and in the Netherlands. You are still doing your PhD on NGOs and women rights in Morocco.
Right.
And I also have seen that you have done research about Moroccan youth in the Netherlands with an identity crisis.
Right.
I'm really interested to hear if you have ever been yourself in an identity crisis.
Of course. I mean, my own identity crisis was the whole reason I did that research.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh my God. Yeah. I think my teenage years around 15, 16, when I met my mom, I think that was the moment I had a real identity crisis. Am I Moroccan? Am I Dutch? What do I want to be? What do I want to make of myself? I was so insecure. I just didn't know what identity meant. So I started studying it. And then I knew identity is your gender or your cultural background or the clothes you wear, or it's just who you are. You know, like you're built by so many things and that's your identity. And it's okay to change it sometimes. It's okay that your identity shifts. It's not like that's what one of the first things they teach you when you study anthropology is it's dynamic. Culture is dynamic. Identities shift, and thank God they do. Life is so more fun if you know that I'm okay with myself, and I'm 26 years old, and 20 years from now, I'll be 46 and probably will be a different woman. But in the essence of me, I'm still this content, happy, ambitious woman with fire in her soul. You know, that's me.
I like that, the fire in the soul. I love the fire.
You know, but it's okay that other things around that change. What I didn't do when I had that identity crisis, saw the youth also in my research do, is they were looking for something to attach their identity to. So they have always something to grab when they feel lost. So they do that with their families, or the older participants in my research did that with spouses, or they did that with jobs. And I see that happening around myself like all the time, like friends who do that, or people I know, or my colleagues, whatever. And that's okay, you know, that's their process, and I have full respect for that. But I think in my life, what is important and what always will be important is that I make sure that I attach my identity to myself, no matter what happens around me. And that can all be part of me and become part of me, but we can also go to a point where I have to let go of that. And then it's not a part of my identity anymore. So I think that's where I'm standing right now, but where I wasn't when I had that crisis and that feeling of loss and just no idea, like literally no idea what you're doing here on earth.
How do you introduce yourself to a stranger at a party?
I am Malika. I don't tell them what I do.
Love it.
I don't tell them what I love. I only tell them my name. And if they ask me what I do for a living, then I tell them. So, yeah, you know.
Cool. Yes. What is your superpower?
Oh, wow.
Beside the fire in your soul.
I think my superpower is something I train every day. And that's my ability to not give up. That's my superpower. I never give up. Never, ever. Even when your mom dies, the one who gives you life. And yes, I've felt moments when I wanted to, but because I didn't, I think I have developed that superpower of not giving up.
What is your connection with God?
This conversation, having a coffee, having a walk, dancing for 3 hours straight. Everything I do tells something about the connection I have with God and what his connection is with me. I don't believe in acting as if there is only one way to work on that connection, which means prayer. I pray, I meditate, but those are one ways or two ways of 1,001 ways to be connected with God.
Nice, very nice. What's one thing that most people do not know about you?
That's a good question, because I don't like to talk about it. I think one thing most people don't know about me is, okay, this is a brutally honest answer that I'm going to give. I think it's still my ability to not be able to fully trust human beings. I still find that difficult. There are a few people in my life that I trust, like, you know, like with my eyes closed. But I think if I say that I trust you only for 90%. And a lot of people don't know that.
Where do you think that doubt comes from, the 10% to not trust of 10%?
I keep going back to it, but it's really that. I think the trauma I have from my mother's death, it's learning as a child to only build on yourself and therefore have a certain special relationship with commitment. I'm not going to say that it's a bad relationship or whatever. No, commitment is just a challenge for me, because the one you're most committed with, you know, is absent in from a certain period of time. So I had to learn how to build on myself or how to trust myself, only myself, from a very young age. So that's what you do. The one person you completely trust is only you.
What will be the wings that you would like to give your children?
Well, I hope those wings will be filled with, first, the most unconditional love. I really don't care about what you're going to do, as long as you are happy. And as long as you know that I'm always here, even when I'm not, or maybe not, you know, physically. I think I will fill those wings also with confidence, raising them with the knowledge that they can be and they can become whatever they want to become. If you have a dream living in your heart, that's worth fighting for. And I really hope that they will become adults who pass that on, who not only think of their own well-being, but also of the well-being of the world they live in, of the society, of the people around them, that they become people who care and that they know the power of caring and the importance of caring.
Thank you so much, Malika. This was such a great conversation. I really loved it so much. And even though I know you a lot, I didn't know that I didn't know things about you. Especially the one that most people don't know about you, the 90% rule.
But I'm working on that.
I appreciate it so much.
Thank you for having me. I really liked it. I loved it.
I hope that this is an inspiration for many, many girls in your shoes, and that they have learned a lot from you, how you have dealt with things. Thank you so much.
Bridging is a podcast produced by me, Özlem Özkan. If you have enjoyed listening to Bridging, please rate it on Apple Podcasts, subscribe, or even better, tell a friend. Your support will make a huge difference. Thank you so much for listening.